Hello, you are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 20, The Peasant Question in All Its Glory. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. In this episode, we are going to explore the so-called peasant question. This will include the story of how the peasants joined the newly formed Soviet government, but it will not be only that. For all my searching online and in the source books I have available to me, I cannot find enough material for the same kind of detailed retelling of the story to which we have become accustomed. The books I have all mention the peasants' congresses, yes, plural, in November and December, but treat them as a footnote to the grander story of the Bolsheviks creating a functioning worker state. Basically, it is, oh, and the peasants eventually joined in too. I was able to find some old Soviet encyclopedia entries and a few secondhand reports. And John Reed has the entire final chapter of 10 Days That Shook the World dedicated to the peasant congresses, so there is some good stuff in there as well. Basically, I have enough to explain the who, what, when, why of it all, but it is very light on the details. I have to imagine there is some work out there, probably an old Soviet textbook, that explains in detail the dynamics and workings of the peasants' congresses in the late fall and early winter 1917. But I was unable to find it, and so in the interest of getting this episode out, I am working with what I do have to tell the story I can. And then we will move on. But again, that is not going to take too terribly long. And so I thought, while we are here, wouldn't it be a blast to take a look at the theoretical underpinnings of Lenin's and the Bolsheviks' approach to the peasants? Oh, I knew you all would love it. Consider it my holiday gift to you all. Like with just about everything else, the Bolsheviks, with Lenin doing most of the heavy lifting, had worked out some very serious theoretical questions beforehand, and by the end of 1917, were now in a position to put them into practice. So understanding the attitude of the new revolutionary proletarian state to a group that made up 85% of the population of the country is, I think you will agree, kind of, sort of, important. In order to do this, we are going to explore Lenin's own words on the question, starting from 1899 and going right up to the Second Congress of Soviets of Peasants' Deputies in late November, early December, 1917. There are links in the show notes to both the Russian original texts I used, as well as any English translations I could find, if you are interested in reading more for yourself. Hey everyone, Daniel here after the fact. I ran into an issue when I went to publish this on my RSS feed. Long story short, apparently there is a character limit on the RSS page for the show notes, and the hyperlinks count toward that limit. So, unfortunately, I had to remove all the links. They are included in the Patreon version of this episode, which, now that early access is over, I have made free over on the Patreon page. I make all the episodes free over there once early access is over. So if you really want access to the sources that I used for this episode, you can go over there and check it out. Sorry, thank you, and back to the show. By the end, we should have a firm understanding of an often neglected component of Leninist political theory. What exactly is the role of the peasantry in a worker state? And how does one build socialism in a country that is overwhelmingly majority peasant? After that, we will go through the rigmarole of the peasants' congresses of November and December, where we will finally emerge on the other end with a Soviet-based government that has a place for both workers and peasants. Huzzah! One of the earliest instances in which Lenin begins to dissect the peasant question is in Chapter 2 of his work, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, first published in 1899. The chapter itself is titled The Decomposition of the Peasantry. In it, he provides tables and charts and tables and charts and tables of data, showing that the peasantry is being pushed from old feudal agrarian production to commodity-based capitalist production. But he draws an interesting conclusion from all this. Quote, "The Russian communal peasantry is not the antagonist of capitalism, but, on the contrary, its deepest and most stable base. It is the deepest because it is precisely here that, far removed from any kind of artificial influences, and despite the institutions which hamper the development of capitalism, we see the constant formation of the elements of capitalism within the commune itself. And it is the most stable because on agriculture in general and on the peasantry in particular weigh, with the most force, the traditions of old, traditions of patriarchal life, and as a consequence of this, the transformative action of capitalism, the development of the forces of production, the changing of all social relations, etc., are manifesting here with great slowness and gradualness. End quote. He also concludes in this chapter that the peasantry are being divided into two extremes, the rural bourgeoisie and the rural proletariat. The rural bourgeoisie, the so-called prosperous peasants, are producing more than they ever could themselves, because they are hiring other peasants and exploiting their labor, transforming the hired farmhands and the day laborers into the rural proletariat. This conclusion, that the peasantry as a class is being transformed into rural bourgeoisie and rural proletariat, is the through line of the rest of Lenin's thinking on the question of the peasantry and its role in a revolutionary proletariat state. In contrast to Lenin at the end of the 19th century, the Narodniki, and later their SR successors, were pushing this idea that the peasantry would be a natural backstop to the development of capitalism, and that the salvation of Russia from tyranny and the Tsar and the forces of capitalism would be found in the peasantry. In The Development of Capitalism in Russia, Lenin blew that notion out of the water, and he was only getting started. In his article, The Workers' Party and the Peasantry, written in 1901, Lenin recounts the experience of the peasantry in the 40 years since the abolishment of serfdom in Russia in 1861. The peasants were freed from their obligation to the land, but were immediately saddled with new obligations in the form of crushing taxes and redemption payments. In order to meet those new obligations, they had been forced to prostrate themselves before both their old feudal lords and the forces of capital. 40 years after emancipation, the only change in a peasant's status is legal. Materially, the peasantry as a class was hardly any better off. Quote, one might ask where to search for a way out, and by what means to achieve an improvement in the lot of the peasant. The petty peasantry can be freed from the oppression of capital only by linking up to the workers' movement, by helping it in its struggle for a socialist order, for the transformation of the land, as well as other means of production, workshops, factories, machines, etc., into communal property. The attempt to save the peasantry from the onset of capitalism by a defense of small holdings and property would mean fruitlessly delaying societal development, and deceiving the peasant with the illusion of a prosperity possible under even capitalism. It would mean disuniting the toiling classes by creating a privileged position for a minority at the expense of the majority. End quote. But if the peasantry is to place its faith in the workers' movement, then it follows that the working class must support the peasants in their struggle by actively bringing the class struggle to the countryside and the peasant village. He concludes by offering a series of policies designed to ease the burden of the peasantry, which the working class ought to support. These include courts to help check the usury and rents of the landowners, the immediate transfer of at least some land to the peasants so that they would have something for subsistence farming for themselves, and the immediate cancellation of redemption payments coupled with a refund of the overpayments. Because, fun fact, the payments have been calculated based on an inflated valuation of the land at the time, and subject to high interest rates, resulting in peasants paying from 1.5 to 2 times what the land was actually worth when all was said and done. Thus, Lenin began arguing for an alliance between the urban and rural proletariat. In 1902, the RSDLP, still not split into its Menshevik and Bolshevik wings, published its official agrarian program, which was as follows. Quote, for the purposes of doing away with the remains of the old serf order, and in the interest of a free development of the class struggle in the village, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party will strive to achieve 1. The abolishment of redemption and lease payments, as well as any duties that fall at the present time on the peasantry as the tax-paying estate. 2. The abolishment of mutual responsibility and all laws restricting the peasant in the use of his land. 3. The return to the people of sums of money taken from them in the form of redemption and lease payments, the confiscation of monasterial property and local holdings for the purposes of this goal, as well as the imposition of a special tax on the lands of large aristocratic landowners that are taking advantage of redemption loans, and the transfer of sums secured in this way into a special national fund for the cultural and charity needs of rural communities. 4. The institution of peasants' committees, A, for the return to rural communities by means of expropriation, or, in case the land has been transferred many times, of purchase, etc., of those lands which were confiscated from the peasants upon the destruction of serf law, and which serve in the hands of the landowners as a weapon for their enslavement, and B, for the elimination of the remains of serf law which have lingered in the Urals, in Altai, in the western region, and in other regions of the state. 5. The presentation to the courts of the law to lower exorbitantly high rents and to announce as void deals having a slave characteristic. End quote. But 3 years later, the Revolution of 1905 erupted, which gave Lenin plenty of material to analyze how the peasants behave in revolutionary moments. From The Proletariat and the Peasantry, written that year. Quote, "The peasant uprisings have begun. The question of the relationship of a conscious avant-garde proletariat of social democracy to the peasant movement is obtaining an immediate practical significance and must be put in the immediate order of the day in all our party organizations. We must unconditionally support and push this movement ahead, since it is a revolutionary democratic movement. Along with this, we must tirelessly stand on our own proletarian class point of view by organizing the rural proletariat, similarly to the urban proletariat, and the two together into an independent class party, explaining to the peasantry the antagonistic contrast between its interests and the interests of the bourgeois peasantry, and calling them to the struggle for a socialist revolution, demonstrating to them that escape from oppression and poverty lies not in the transformation of some strata of the peasantry into petty bourgeoisie, but in the replacement of the entire bourgeois system with a socialist one." End quote. Lenin observed firsthand that the peasantry, on the whole, have a contradictory potential. They can be revolutionary in their desire to do away with feudalism altogether, and as the class struggle develops, the rural proletariat emerges and becomes all the more potent an ally of the urban proletariat. But the peasantry as a whole is prone to develop the petty bourgeois mindset, and the socialist revolutionaries are erroneously convincing the rural population that if enough peasant families are given enough land, the market will work out the rest. But of course, this will not bring about a resolution of the contradictions the peasantry is experiencing. It will only change their form and expression. Therefore, the RSDLP, as the party of the proletarian masses, must, quote, "support and nudge forward the peasantry right up to the deprival of any kind of sacred, lordly property, insofar as the peasantry behaves in a revolutionary democratic manner. But treat the peasantry incredulously and organize ourselves separately from them. Be ready for a struggle with them, insofar as the peasantry behaves in a reactionary or anti-proletarian manner. Put another way, cooperation with the peasantry when its struggle with the landlord is beneficial to the development and strengthening of democracy. But neutrality in regards to the peasant when his struggle with the landlord is exclusively the settling between two factions of the landowning class of accounts which are of no concern to the proletariat and for democracy." End quote. He later continues, quote, "The Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, as the party of the conscious proletariat, strives for the total liberation of all laborers from any kind of exploitation, and supports any revolutionary movement against the contemporary social and political order. Therefore, the RSDLP supports in the most energetic manner the contemporary peasant movement, and defends all revolutionary measures capable of improving the position of the peasantry, while not stopping short in these goals at the expropriation of land from the landlords. Given this, the RSDLP, being the class party of the proletariat, tirelessly strives for the independent class organization of the rural proletariat, while not forgetting for a minute that our task is to explain to it the antagonistic contrast of its interests and the interests of the peasant bourgeoisie, to explain that only the joint struggle of the rural and urban proletariat against the entirety of bourgeois society can bring us to a socialist revolution, which alone is capable of actually liberating the entire mass of the village poor from poverty and exploitation. As a practical slogan of agitation among the peasants, and as a means of introducing the highest consciousness into this movement, the RSDLP proposes the immediate formation of revolutionary peasant committees for the comprehensive support of all democratic transformations, and in particular, their realization. And in such committees, the RSDLP will strive for an independent organization of the rural proletariat for the purposes of, on the one hand, supporting the entire peasantry in all its revolutionary democratic actions, and, on the other hand, for the purposes of guarding the true interests of the rural proletariat in its struggle against the peasant bourgeoisie. End quote. Later that same year, 1905, in a letter to the Third Party Congress of the RSDLP, in a section titled On Our Agrarian Program, Lenin wrote, quote, "The new peasant movement, growing and strengthening with each day, once again moves to the forefront the question of our agrarian program. The foundational principle of this program, of course, cannot elicit disagreement or argument. The party of the proletariat must support the movement of the peasantry. It will never move to defend contemporary landlord holdings from the revolutionary pressure of the peasants. But along with this, it will always strive for the development of the class struggle in the village and the introduction of consciousness into this struggle." End quote. The peasantry's ability to be, as a unified class, a progressive force in society is limited, in part, by the fact that, beyond the demand for control of land segments for individuals, the contradictions between the rural proletariat and the rural bourgeoisie begin to manifest. The rural proletariat's demand for land and resources is countered by the rural petty bourgeois and bourgeois control of said resources, which deadlocks it into the same dynamic that their urban counterparts experience. But an important difference between the rural and urban examples is that the urban proletariat is demanding group control over the factories and workshops. The peasantry is demanding that each peasant family be allowed to control its own land, therefore becoming, in effect, petty bourgeois landowners. The peasantry, as a whole, can and must go beyond control of land segments, but only on the basis of class struggle, which the working class can and must introduce. Lenin insists that the RSDLP position must be to support revolutionary peasant committees in the countryside, which must first support the struggle against the remnants of feudalism, and then turn around and serve as the basis for struggle against the new capitalist relations of production emerging in its place. We can see here that Lenin has developed a novel approach toward the peasantry. If you will recall way back from episode 1, The Phantom Red Menace, I described how Marx was not particularly convinced of the revolutionary potential of the peasantry as a class, and that the working class was, in Marx's analysis, the truly revolutionary class. The disregard for the revolutionary potential of the peasantry is what today would be considered the orthodox Marxist view. However, it has since been superseded in revolutionary theory and practice by the ideas and experiences of Lenin and then, later, Mao and his comrades in the Chinese Revolution, who drew in large part from the Leninist analysis of the peasantry. But that is a whole other ball of wax. Lenin identified what he believed to be the uniqueness of Russia's historical development at that specific time, being at a crossroads between feudal and capitalist modes of production at the dawn of the 20th century. The peasantry was being subjected to the dialectical contradictions, both of the feudal order being replaced by an expanding capitalist order, and of the capitalist order itself. As long as remnants of feudalism remained, all the peasants, no matter to which rural neo-class they belonged, had a material interest in freeing themselves of the old order entirely. But insofar as capitalist relations were starting to supplant the feudal order naturally, the peasantry was beginning to break apart as a class and stratify into its versions of the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The Vanguard Workers' Party would find a natural ally in the rural proletariat, the day laborers and hired hands whose labor was being exploited and whose surplus value was being extracted in agrarian production in much the same way as the factory workers was in industrial production. And therein lies the complexity of the agrarian question for the Social Democrats of the RSDLP and later the Communist Bolsheviks. The long-term goals and strategy of the party regarding the proletariat class were clear because of the transparent nature of the class struggle for the proletariat. Organize the working class, raise the class consciousness of the masses, and declare war on the bourgeoisie. When it came to the peasantry, however, due to the complex and nuanced socioeconomic relations between the lingering feudal order and the emerging capitalist order, the RSDLP program was of necessity more complex and nuanced. There, the goal was to support the complete eradication of lingering serfdom and the feudal order, but only in order to hasten the establishment of capitalist relations in the countryside, so that the countryside can then be brought into the struggle alongside the urban workers. So we now have a fairly comprehensive understanding of Lenin's theoretical position on the peasants and the working class. But we have still got 12 years to go before October 1917, and along the way, Lenin had plenty to say about specific policies and questions being addressed in the intervening years. For example, in 1906, in the first Duma, the land question was being discussed. Specifically, there were two main proposals, one from the cadets and one from the Trudoviks. Lenin, in The Question on Land and the Struggle for Freedom, offers his criticisms of both, starting with the cadet proposal to allow the land to be purchased at so-called fair market price. Quote, "Whatever rules regarding communal land buyouts and so on are written on paper, in fact, the land will unavoidably remain in the hands of those who can buy it. This is why land buyouts lead to the strengthening of rich peasants at the expense of the poor, the division of the peasantry, to the weakening by means of this division of the peasantry in its struggle for total freedom and for all the land. A buyout leads to the more prosperous peasants being poached from the cause of freedom onto the side of the old order. To buy out the land means to be bought off from the struggle for freedom. A buyout is a distraction, by means of money, of a portion of the fighters for freedom onto the side of the opponents of freedom. The prosperous peasant who has bought himself land becomes a small landowner, and his switch over to the side of the old landowning bureaucratic order will be particularly easy and durable. This is why the words of the Social Democratic Congress are completely justified, that the Cadet Party, this half-landowner's party, is defending measures which weaken the revolutionary movement, that is, the struggle for freedom." End quote. The Trudovic proposal was a bit more socialist in nature, banning private ownership of the land, but Lenin sees a flaw even in this. Even if a law were passed forbidding private ownership of the land, use of the land would never be democratic, as long as the power of capital remains. There is therefore a hard limit to the utility of such reforms that leave capitalism intact, even while pursuing a radical land program. Quote, "The conscious proletariat with all its might supports the peasant struggle for all the land and for total freedom, but it also warns the peasants about any kind of false hopes. Peasants can, with the help of the proletariat, throw off the power of the landowners, can put an end entirely to control of the land by landowners and the land-owning bureaucratic state. Peasants can even destroy private ownership of the land entirely. All these measures will yield enormous benefits to the peasantry, and to the working class, and to the entire nation. The interests of the working class demand the most amicable support of the peasant struggle. But the most complete overthrow of the power of landowners and bureaucrats will not in any way undermine the power of capital. And only in a society where there is no landowner or bureaucratic authority will the last great struggle between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, the struggle for a socialist system, be decided." End quote. Lenin ends with a stark warning and words of wisdom to the peasantry in their struggle, urging them not to be swayed from the path. Quote, "In order to achieve success in the current struggle for land and for freedom, peasants must act entirely self-sufficiently and independently from the cadets. Peasants must not become involved in scrutinizing all kinds of projects for the arrangement of the land. The peasant struggle for land is only weakened by this heap of paragraphs and rules and projects, which the old order will either toss out entirely or turn into a new method of deceiving the peasant. These projects clutter the mind with dreams of benevolent authority, when in fact the old savage authority remains with all its unlimited violence." End quote. Jumping ahead to 1913, in The Peasantry and the Working Class, Lenin addressed the claim being made at the time by the populists and SRs that the peasantry and the working class compose a single class. This was something Lenin understood to be a theoretical error that would lead to wrong actions if not corrected. To counter this claim, Lenin presented a few contemporary figures from Austria and Germany that showed that the more land a single peasant family owns, the more wage labor they exploit, which he argues means that the peasantry are not of a single class with the proletariat, that the term working peasant actually describes two separate kinds of relations of production, both a small business owner who hires wage laborers to work his farmland, and those who are hired to work the land of someone else. I am not going to read the figures out here because nothing makes me personally zone out faster when listening to a podcast than being read a list of numbers. When it comes to numbers, I am very much a visual learner, as I know many people are. So instead, let's just skip to the punchline. Quote, "In this way, the very position of petty landholders in contemporary society transforms them unavoidably into petty bourgeoisie. They are eternally vacillating between hired workers and capitalists. The majority of peasants live in poverty and are broken by it, turning into proletarians, and the minority reach for the capitalists and support the independence from them of the mass of the rural population. Therefore, in all capitalist countries, the peasantry in the main remains even today on the sideline of the socialist movement of workers, joining with various reactionary and bourgeois parties. Only a self-sufficient organization of wage laborers, waging a consistent class struggle, is in a state to tear the peasantry away from the influence of the bourgeoisie and to explain to it the entirely hopeless position of petty producers in a capitalist society. In Russia, the position of the peasants in regard to capitalism is entirely uniform with that which we see in Austria, Germany, and so on. Our uniqueness is our backwardness. The peasant is not faced with a capitalist, but with a feudal large landholder, which is the main buttress of both the economic and political backwardness in Russia." End quote. This brings us to 1917 proper. The final primary document I want to go over for this section is Lenin's speech to the first All-Russian Congress of Soviets of Peasants' Deputies, given on the 22nd of May. And reminder, we are still old style. We actually referenced this in episode 7, The Party and the People, but I offered only the briefest of summaries at the time. Now, we are going to dig into the meat of what Lenin had to say. In his speech, he defended the Bolshevik program of nationalization of the land. The SRs, the cadets, and the landowners were objecting that peasants taking over the land would be an exercise in arbitrary despotism of the masses. Lenin countered by arguing that, according to the 1905 census, which he freely admits is not objectively accurate, since it had been undertaken by the notoriously inefficient Tsarist government, but is still the most accurate information available. Across European Russia, about 30,000 individuals control about 75 million desyatiny, while 10 million peasant households have about another 75 million desyatiny. A desyatina is an old Russian unit of land measurement. 75 million desyatiny is about 750,000 square kilometers. So half the land is owned by 30,000 individuals, while the other half is owned by 10 million. This is the basis for rejecting most of the criticisms leveled at the Bolsheviks, and the calls against peasants taking over the land. Lenin argued it was unjust to make them wait, that the peasants taking over the land was no more arbitrary despotism than was the landowners holding on to what they had. Since everyone agreed that the Constituent Assembly would be where the matter would finally be addressed. Yet, at that precise moment, the peasants were suffering directly from their lack of access to the land. Lenin called the landowners out directly. They were trying to secure for themselves the most compensation for their land. You might think, well, of course, it's been their land for centuries. Why should they part with it freely? Besides the moral claim of the peasantry having infused their own blood and sweat into the produce of the land for centuries, while the landlords sat in palatial estates or spent most of their time in the cities, very visibly not infusing their labor into the produce of the land, there was another, more immediate issue with this behavior. The landowners' insistence on now getting paid top ruble for selling or renting out their land came at the expense of the well-being of the nation, which was on the verge of total economic collapse. The landowners, as a class, had accumulated their fortunes and their influence through centuries of brutal exploitation of serf and peasant labor. But that was not enough for them. Now, faced with the demand with an end to that way of life by millions of starving people across the country, they were trying to line their own pockets even further. Rather disgusting and unpatriotic behavior, which Lenin pointed out again and again. Lenin also mocked the idea of a voluntary agreement with these landlords, articulating in the specific case of poor peasants versus landlords and rich peasants one of the most basic general contradictions of capitalist production, that there is no voluntary agreement when one side has an overwhelming advantage in strength or power or economic productive capacity. First of all, if the basis of the agreement between the peasants and the landlords is to be mutually beneficial economic exchange, then only those peasants who already can pay, who already have the resources to secure bank loans and hire more workers, will be able to rent or purchase the land. The rest of the peasantry will have no option but to become the rural proletariat. And the idea of free labor on free land means that the inequalities that were holdovers from serfdom and feudalism and which had sprung up under developing capitalist relations would only be exacerbated. One cannot work the land without tools and machines and implements, and those too poor to buy them will have to sell their labor to work the land, which negates the very idea of free labor on free land. The existence and power of capital will always twist and pervert even the most progressive attempts at addressing poverty and inequality. And so, and here comes Lenin's pitch for the peasants to join forces with the Bolsheviks, the power of capital must be done away with altogether. Lenin is very clear that he supports local administration of the land until a worker state is established and able to take over. Quote, "It is clear that the institution of the definitive management of this land, the definitive institution of land order, should be undertaken only by a central state authority, that is, by the Constituent Assembly or the All-Russian Soviet of Soviets, if such an authority, a Soviet of Soviets, the peasant and working masses create. Those are called anarchists who reject the necessity of state power. Undoubtedly, the strongest authority is necessary. But we only want this authority to be entirely and exclusively in the hands of the majority of workers, soldiers, and peasants' deputies. We do not in any way deny the necessity of strong state authority. We are only saying that all of the landowners' land must be transferred for free into the hands of the peasants, according to a decision taken by the majority of the local peasant committee." End quote. He ended his speech with the appeal that only state ownership of the land, in the name of a revolutionary proletariat and peasant state, with communal laboring of the land, will truly free the peasants and rural proletariat, and solve the crisis into which capitalism and the imperial capitalist world war had led Russia and the rest of the world. He acknowledges it will be a long, difficult journey to get to that point, but foresees that by the end, the masses will succeed and be all the better for it. Lenin's development of the theory of the revolutionary peasantry was, well, revolutionary. It was a novelty in the history of Russian socialism. Prior to Lenin, the orthodox Marxist view was, as I said previously, that the peasantry do not really have a place in a socialist revolution. Their material conditions preclude their involvement. They are, at best, impossible to rouse to action, and at worst, inherently reactionary. And so, there was not really a theory of how to harness the peasant masses in a proletarian revolution. This view can be attributed to material conditions in Western European countries in the mid-19th century, conditions which differed in several key ways from those in Russia in late 19th, early 20th century. Karl Marx was preoccupied with the countries in which capitalist development had advanced the furthest: France, Britain, Germany, and occasionally the United States. In those nations, the proletariat were large classes, well over half the population. Capitalist development had transformed enough of the peasantry in those nations into wage laborers. What peasantry was left had been thoroughly transformed into petty bourgeois small landholders. It was to this view that the father of Russian Marxism, Grigory Valentinovich Plekhanov, subscribed, and he in turn influenced almost all Russian Marxists to adopt this view as well. Lenin was the first one to reapply dialectical materialist analysis to the situation in Russia. Instead of simply insisting that Marx's analysis of French peasants from the 1850s was the universal and unchanging law of how peasants work in society, Lenin was able to forge a new theory specific to his place and time. And because his analysis was dialectical, rooted in specific historical material contradictions and how they were playing out, his theory proved to be the more revolutionarily dynamic. I have said it before, and I will say again here, Marxism is not a collection of rigid, orthodox proclamations on the nature of the world and spiteful criticisms of capitalism. It is a living form of analysis of contradictions that are always present. The methodology of dialectical materialism does not change, but if applied properly, dialectical materialism will always yield unique and nuanced insights into how society functions and how it can be changed. And something else I have said before and will say again here. Lenin was, quite simply, one of the best dialectical materialist analytical minds to have ever existed. He looked beneath the surface of the peasant masses and saw that, since capitalism was starting to spread into the Russian countryside, the peasant class was undergoing a profound transformation. He recognized that it was within the contradictions between the lingering Russian feudal order, the emerging capitalist order, and the stratification of the peasant class into its own proletarian and bourgeois sections that the peasantry did, in fact, have a role to play in a socialist revolution in Russia. Lenin, effectively, found the answer to the peasant question. It was an answer that future Marxist-Leninist revolutionaries would build on when they effected their socialist revolutions. And so, I think it is safe to say it is another pillar of Marxism-Leninism as a revolutionary ideology, and can be counted among Lenin's most valuable contributions to the global struggle against imperialism and capitalism. Thanks, Lenin. You did us a real solid. But there is one tiny shadow I have to cast over all this. Even though Lenin argues that the peasantry do have revolutionary potential and that they must be made into allies of the proletariat, he of course never loses sight of the fact that it is the proletariat that is the vanguard class in a capitalist society, not the peasantry. The peasants' innate aspirations to become self-sufficient farmers and small landholders is, in the end, a petty bourgeois tendency, and it does put them at odds with the workers in key ways. Lenin wrote in his letter to the Third Party Congress of the RSDLP in 1905 that, quote, "We must strengthen the peasants' connection with the proletariat and support the peasant movement, all while not losing sight of the possessive tendencies of the peasant farmer, tendencies whose hostility to the proletariat will manifest all the sooner and more sharply the faster the revolution progresses," end quote. So he knows there is going to be a clash between the two classes. And of course, he knew that the antagonism between the two groups must be resolved in favor of the working class in order to escape capitalism and end class struggle altogether. This is something I want you to keep in mind when we get to the attitude and relationship of the Soviet government toward the peasants in the 1920s and 1930s. If we are taught anything at all about that period of Soviet history and how the peasants were treated by the Soviet government, it is that the hapless peasants had their aspirations for freedom brutally crushed through state violence and famine. But in point of fact, and we will obviously explore this in great detail when we get there, any Soviet government hostility toward the peasants was a reaction to the peasants' hostility toward the government, and even then, to the hostility of the specifically petty bourgeois elements in the countryside. Now we have a clear theoretical understanding of where that hostility came from. Lenin warned everyone what would happen, and he was clear and unapologetic about the outcome for which the proletariat must strive. He may have hoped for the best, but he was a sober realist, and he knew that some clash between a revolutionary worker state and the petty bourgeois tendencies inherent in the peasantry was going to erupt sooner or later. And when it did, the party of the workers must defend its own interests against even the peasant masses. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. This show is 100% listener funded and always will be. Become a Patreon of the Sickle and the Hammer today. There are multiple tiers, each with their own bag of goodies, depending on what you sign up for. Best of all, early access to episodes starts at the Comrade tier for just $5 a month. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. If you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast service you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. When we last left the Soviet government, the Sovnarkom had been formed as the executive of the new government, and the Central Executive Committee, which I shortened to its Russian acronym CEK, of the Second Congress of Soviets of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, was the legislature of the new government. But the peasants had yet to weigh in. They were now being represented by two split parties. The left SRs, who represented more the poor and working peasants, and the right SRs, who represented more the wealthy peasants and landowning class. If you recall from last time, the Bolsheviks struggled mightily against the right socialist parties and even the right wing of their own party to defend the gains of the October Revolution and the program of the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, which I probably should have been calling the Second Workers' Congress this whole time because, geez Louise, what a mouthful. But the peasants had yet to chime in, and it was because of this that the CEK of the Second Workers' Congress convoked the Extraordinary All-Russian Congress of Soviets of Peasants' Deputies, which I will call simply the Extraordinary Congress. The goal of the Extraordinary Congress was to have representatives of the peasants lend their support, officially and publicly, to the new government. The reason this is called the Extraordinary Congress is because it was not the regular Second Congress. The First Congress had taken place in May, and only either the peasants and the Soviets or the CEK from the First Peasants Congress could call the Second Congress. But the Bolsheviks and the new Soviet government really needed the peasants to lend at least provisional support for their new government, and so, over the heads of the CEK of the First Peasants Congress, it should be said, they convoked this Extraordinary Congress until the regular Second Congress could be convoked. But if the Bolsheviks and left SRs wanted peasant support for the new government, the right SRs did not want such support to be granted. And so they attempted to prevent the Congress from taking place, even going so far as to try to prevent the deputies from personal contact with the Bolsheviks, for fear the Bolsheviks would infect them with their ideas. However, Bolshevik activists and organizers were too good at their jobs, and the extraordinary Congress took place from the 11th to the 25th of November, 1917, in Petrograd. At the opening session, only about 260 delegates were in attendance, but more arrived every day, so that by the 18th, 330 were present. Out of these, 195 were left SRs, 37 were Bolsheviks, and the rest were majority right SR, combined with some smaller groups and parties. In preparation for this extraordinary Congress, Lenin composed his Instructions to the Peasants. He realized that, across the vastness of the country, a great many number of peasants had not yet heard of the overthrow of the provisional government, or had heard conflicting reports about what it all meant, and what the new Soviet government stood for. Lenin therefore wrote a brief outline of what had happened, explaining that the Soviet government was now the official government of Russia, and that local peasant committees and Soviets were officially empowered to take the land from the landholders and administer it directly themselves. These instructions fulfilled two very important needs. It made sure everyone at the Congress was on the same page, literally, it was about a page worth of text in all, and up to speed about the events of the past month. But also, it was phenomenal propaganda for the Bolsheviks and the Soviet government. Here's what we, the new Soviet government, are doing for you peasants out in the countryside. Please keep this in mind when discussing the new Soviet government. According to John Reed in his 10 Days, the extraordinary Congress did not start out all that favorably predisposed toward Lenin and the Bolsheviks. Many delegates arrived in a very reactionary mood, as they had just arrived from the provinces, where rumors swirled and the right SRs were effective at muddying the waters. But, as the days of the Extraordinary Congress passed, the delegates quickly swung hard to the left in favor of the left SR and Bolshevik positions. Lenin himself spoke three times at the Extraordinary Congress, which undoubtedly played a crucial role in that swing. He implored the left SRs to recognize that they could not achieve their goals of equal access to the land and its produce under capitalism, and that they must join forces with the workers. He explained that the workers wanted control over the factories in the exact same manner that the peasants wanted control over the land. The workers' government had granted them that control. Would the peasants not reciprocate? Such appeals had their intended effect. By the end of the Extraordinary Congress, the majority of the delegates were with the left SRs. They enthusiastically confirmed the program of the Second Workers' Congress, the decrees on peace and land that had been adopted, and, most importantly, approved a resolution to merge the tsiks of the two congresses into one, effectively merging the peasants with the existing Soviet government. The first session of the new unified tsik took place on the 15th of November in Smolny. Now, again, this was all provisional, but the symbolic impact of this merger was very real. The peasants had all but officially joined the new Soviet government. After a couple of days of talks and negotiations, the Sovnarkom was reorganized to include left SRs. Andrei Lukich Kolegayev became the Commissar of Agriculture, Isaac Zakharovich Steinberg became Commissar of Justice, Vladimir Yevgenievich Trutovsky became Commissar of Local Self-Governance, and Prosh Perchevich Proshian, an Armenian left SR, became Commissar of Post and Telegraph. One of the last important acts of the Extraordinary Congress was its convocation of the regular Second Congress of Soviets of Peasants' Deputies. This Second Congress took place from the 26th of November to the 10th of December, 1917. Opening the day after the Extraordinary Congress closed. Thus, for our purposes, we have arrived at the final act in the formation of the new Soviet government. When the Congress opened on the 26th, it was full of exactly the kind of tension and drama you would expect. The left SR, Maria Alexandrovna Spiridonova, was the chair, which was a huge indication of the strength of the left at this Congress. but that did not stop the right SRs from accusing Lenin of aspiring to replace Tsar Nikolai personally, or from actively heckling Trotsky to the point that Trotsky could barely get out three words. The right SRs did their best to prevent the Congress from doing its work, but they were a small minority at this point, and all their heckling and obstructionism resulted in a split in the Congress. On the 4th of December, the left and right wings of the Congress began meeting separately. The left immediately declared itself the only true continuation of the Congress, and the right was basically pushed into irrelevance before walking out altogether, repeating their actions and mistakes during the Second Workers' Congress in October. Unfortunately, the details of what exactly the business was that the Second Peasants' Congress addressed, I could not find. But I would imagine they included discussing support for the Bolshevik majority government, the land question for the peasants, and whether to join the majority Bolshevik government. Again, this is an educated guess on my part, but regardless of what they discussed, the question of joining the government was finally settled on the 15th of December, 1917. On that day, the Central Executive Committee of the Congress of Soviets of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies, and the Executive Committee of the Congress of Peasants' Deputies, merged into the Central Executive Committee of the Congress of Soviets of Workers', Soldiers', and Peasants' Deputies. In the final chapter of 10 Days That Shook the World, titled The Peasant Congress, John Reed describes, quite movingly, I might add, just how euphoric everyone was at the close of the Second Peasants' Congress and the merging of the workers and peasants into a unified people's government. There were cheers, grown men and women were hugging and kissing on the streets, and a pervasive sense that they had done it. Not only had they overthrown the bourgeoisie, the aristocracy, and the landowner class, they had created a new government of, by, and for the masses. The toiling masses of Russia had taken direct control over their own lives. They knew, of course, that the struggle was not over. But for those few days in December in Petrograd, 1917, the excitement and joy and pride were all palpable and fully justified. The peasants were officially part of the government, and the party that represented their interests, the left SRs, stood shoulder to shoulder with the Bolsheviks. Together, they would usher in an exciting new era for Russia and for the world. I just really hope that neither party does anything stupid in about 6 months to blow everything up. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars, Alex D, Big Easy H, Bryce Holder, Cage 433, Cap Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Josue Ponce, Nicodemus, Rasmussen Svensson, Ryan Fowler, Rodion Maximovich, Sam McGeever, Zach Wheatley, and Zone. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания!